Chapter 18. Battle General Jan Polis Leroux stood upon the heights above the Tugela and removed his Terai hat. His head was bald with a fringe of ginger hair above the ears and thick around the back. The skin of his pate was smooth and creamy white, where the hat had protected it from the sun, but his face had been weathered and sculptured by the elements until it looked like a cliff of red stone. "Bring my pony, Enny," he spoke to the lad who stood beside him.
"Ja, Paul,"
and he hurried away down the reverse slope to the pony lager. From the firing trench at Jan Polis's feet, one of the burghers looked up at him.
"God has heard our prayers, Paul. He has given us a great victory."
Jan Polis nodded heavily, and his voice, as he replied, was low and humble, without any trace of jubilation.
"Ja, Fredovic. In God's name, a great victory."
But not as great as he had planned it. Out of cannon shot, almost out of range of the naked eye, the last tattered remnants of the British were dwindling into the brown distance. If only they could have waited, he thought with bitterness. So clearly I explained it to them, and they did not heed me. His whole strategy had revolved upon the bridge. If only his burghers on the kopje below the heights had held their fire and let them cross. Then God would have delivered the enemy to them in thousands instead of hundreds. Caught in the amphitheatre of the heights, with the river at their backs, none of them would have escaped when his artillery destroyed the bridge behind them. Sadly, he looked down upon the trap he had laid with such infinite care. From above, he could see the trenches, each of them, masked and cunningly overlapped, so that an unbearable fire could sweep the grassy bowl into which he had hoped to lure the British centre. The trap that would never be sprung, for he knew they would not come again. Henny climbed back to him, leading his pony, and Jan Polis mounted quickly.
"Come on, let us go down."
At 42 years of age, Jan Polis Leroux was very young for the command he held. There had been opposition in Pretoria to his appointment when old Joubert retired, but President Kruger had ridden roughshod over it and forced the Volkerrad to accept. 10 minutes before, Jan Polis had sent him a telegraphed message which had justified this confidence. With long stirrup leathers, his massive body loose and relaxed in the saddle, his shambok trailing from his wrist and the wide-brimmed hat shading his face, Jan Polis went down to gather the harvest of war. As he reached the kopjes and rode in among them, his burghers rose from their trenches on the slopes and cheered him. Their voices blended in a savage roar that echoed from the heights, like the jubilation of lions on a new kill. Impassively, Jan Polis examined their faces as he passed. They were coated with red dust and burnt powder, and sweat had run in dark lines through the grime. One man used his rifle as a crutch to balance himself against his wound, and there were harsh lines of pain around his mouth as he cheered. Jan Polis checked his pony.
"Lie down, don't be a fool, man."
The man grinned painfully and shook his head.
"Nia Paul, I'm going with you to fetch the guns."
Brusquely, Jan Polis motioned to the men who stood beside the wounded burgher.
"Take him away. Take him to the doctor's."
And he trotted on to where Commandant van Wyk waited for him.
"I told you to hold your men until they crossed," he greeted him,
and van Wyk's grin faded.
"Ja, Paul, I know, but I could not hold them. The young ones started it. When they saw the guns right there under their noses, I could not hold them."
Van Wyk turned and pointed across the river.
"Look how near they were."
Jan Polis looked across the river. The guns were standing in the open, so close and so lightly screened by the intervening thorn scrub that he could count the spokes of the wheels and see the sparkle of the brass breech fittings.
"It was too much temptation," van Wyk ended lamely. "So, it is done, and we cannot undo it with words."
Grimly, Jan Polis determined that this man would never command again.
"Come, we will fetch them."
At the road bridge, Jan Polis halted the long column of horsemen behind him. Although none of it showed on his face, yet his stomach heaved with horror at what he saw.
"Move them," he ordered.
And as the 30 burghers dismounted and went forward to clear the bridge, he called out after them,
"Handle them gently. Lift them. Do not drag them away like mealy sacks. These were men. Brave men."
Beside him, the boy Henny was crying openly. the tears falling onto his patched tweed jacket. "Be still, young," Jan Polis murmured gently. "Dears of a woman." And he urged his pony into the narrow passage between the dead. It was the dust and the sun and the lyddite fumes which had irritated his own eyes, he told himself angrily. Quietly, lacking the triumphant bearing of victors, they came to the guns and spread out among them. Then a single rifle shot cracked out, and a burgher staggered and clutched the wheel of a gun carriage for support. Whirling his pony and flattening himself along its neck, Jan Polis charged the donga beyond the guns from which the shot had come. Another shot hissed past his head, but by then Jan Polis had reached the donga. Pulling his mount down from full gallop onto its haunches, he jumped from the saddle and kicked the rifle out of the British private's hands before dragging him to his feet. "We have killed too much already, you fool," stumbling over the English words, his tongue clumsy with rage. He roared into the soldier's face, "It is finished! Give up!" And then turning on the surviving gunners who huddled along the donga, "Give up! Give up, all of you!" None of them moved for a long minute. Then slowly, one at a time, they stood up and shuffled out of the donga. While a party of Boers led the prisoners away, and the others went about the business of hitching up the guns and the ammunition wagon, the British stretcher-bearers began filtering forward through the mimosa trees. Soon khaki figures were mingled everywhere with the burghers, as they searched like bird dogs for the wounded. Two of them, dark-skinned Indians of the medical corps, had found a man lying out on the left flank. They were having difficulty with him, and Jan Polis handed the reins of his pony to Henny and walked across to them. In semi-delirium, the wounded man was cursing horribly and resisting all attempts by the two Indians to fix splints onto his leg. "Leave me alone, you bastards!" and a flying fist knocked one of them sprawling. Jan Polis, recognizing the voice and the punch, started to run. "You behave yourself or I'll clop you one," he growled as he reached them. Groggily Sean rolled his head and tried to focus on him. "Who's that? Who are you? Get the hell away from me!" Jan Polis did not answer. He was looking at the wounds, and they made him want to vomit. "Give to me!" He took the splints from the shaken bearers and squatted down beside Sean. "Get away!" Sean screamed at him. "I know what you're going to do! You're going to cut it off!" "Sean!" Jan Polis caught his wrist and held it while Sean writhed and swore. "I'll kill you, you filthy bastard! I'll kill you if you touch it! Sean, it's me! Look at me!" And slowly Sean relaxed. His eyes steadied. "It's you. It's really you," he whispered. "Don't let them. Don't let them take my leg. Not like they did to Gary." "Be still or I'll break your stupid head," growled Jan Polis. Like his face, his hands were beefy and red, big hands with fingers like calloused sausages, but now they worked as gently as those of a mother on her child. At last, holding the ankle, he looked at Sean. "Hold fast now. I must straighten it." Sean tried to grin, but his face was grey beneath the coating of battle filth, and sweat squeezed from his skin like a rash of tiny blisters. "Don't talk so much, you bloody Dutchman. Do it." Bone grated on broken bone, deep in the torn flesh, and Sean gasped. Every muscle in his body convulsed and then relaxed again as he fainted. "Yeah," grunted Jan Polis. "That's better." And for the first time, the set of his features betrayed his compassion. He finished with the bandages and for a few seconds continued to squat beside Sean's unconscious body. Then he whispered so low that the two bearers could not catch the words. "Sleep well, my brother. May God spare you your leg." And he stood, all trace of pity and sorrow locked away behind the red stone of his face. "Take him away," he ordered, and waited while they lifted the stretcher and staggered away with it. He went to his pony, and his feet dragged a little through the grass. From the saddle he looked once more towards the south, but the two bearers had disappeared with their burden among the mimosa trees. He touched spurs to his pony's flanks and followed the long procession of wagons, prisoners and guns back towards the Tugela. The only sound was the jingle of harness and the melancholy rumble of wheels.